Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Friday, July 15th, 2022. The weatherman is saying that it is going to be a hot and sunny day here in Nashville with little chance of rain. Thank you to Ron Trammell and his Cats Tribute Band for contributing our intro music for the podcast. On today's show, I want to travel with me to northeastern Pennsylvania, and specifically to Wilkes-Barre, my hometown, and its surrounding counties. The city symbol for the city of Wilkes-Barre is a beehive, and I'm certain that the symbol was chosen to invoke the dynamism that once was Wilkes-Barre. Before the time of the Great Depression, Wilkes-Barre was a major manufacturing hub producing everything from silk to automobiles and steam locomotives. And at the root of all that industry was the extraction of anthracite coal. For well over 100 years, there have been active mines in that area, deep mines and strip mines, taking advantage of one of the world's richest deposits of anthracite coal. From an environmental standpoint, this industry was virtually unregulated until the time of the Clean Water Act and the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency in the 70s. The sights and sounds and smells of my growing up in the 1950s and 60s include giant steam shovels, mine breakers and rail yards and sidings with long strings of coal trains. And this industry has left a rather ugly legacy, not just the piles of refuse which are seen around the landscape, thankfully not so much as before, but more importantly, with the drainage of tainted water from the mines into rivers and streams. And the scale of the problem is enormous. Today we speak with Bobby Hughes, who is the executive director of the Eastern Pennsylvania Coalition for Abandoned Mine Reclamation. Bobby is a highly regarded young environmental activist who has received numerous awards for his activities, including seeking to remediate the damage which has been done by the coal industry. We'll learn from him directly the scope of the problem and about the multifaceted activities which are ongoing to bring the lands back into productive use. Bobby graduated from Penn State in May of 1995 with a degree in environmental resource management with a concentration in water pollution control technologies and hydrogeology. He has been at the leadership role at EPCARM since 1997. As you will hear, Bobby has an exquisite knowledge of the subject and the territory of northeastern Pennsylvania. And I hope you'll enjoy my interview with Bobby Hughes. We will get started right after this brief message.
Hi, this is Heather Lose, Editor-in-Chief of the Tennessee Conservationist Magazine. Every year, we publish six beautiful issues packed full of timely and informative stories about Tennessee culture, people, and places. You can stay informed about your world and all the great things happening in your Tennessee state parks. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website at tnconservationist.org. Thank you.
Bobby Hughes, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Hey, good morning, Mark.
Bob, it's great to have you, and I just want to set the stage for the audience. I'm recording here in Nashville, Tennessee, and you are in, I presume, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, pretty close to Wilkes-Barre, yeah. We're in a one-square-mile municipality called Ashley, Pennsylvania, but it's just on the outskirts of Wilkes-Barre.
Yeah, that county is loaded with the little townships and municipalities. Each have their own little identity, isn't that right?
Oh yeah, yeah. There's so many little towns, and you know, within one municipality, it could have three different names before you leave it, just because the neighborhoods are sectioned off, and many of them are, you know, dependent on the location of where you live. You know, you could be from a tougher neighborhood, or you could be from, you know, if you're across the river, there's just lots of nice little areas that get predefined. And, you know, maybe that goes a lot back into the coal history of the
region.
Well,
it's all about the history, isn't it? And the ethnic neighborhoods also in those communities.
True.
I can remember as a kid traveling from one community to the other, and the signs on the buildings were sometimes in Italian and sometimes in Polish, and just amazing, amazing stuff.
Yeah, well, there's no shortages of pizza places, bars, and churches throughout this particular region. They're on every corner, it seems.
So, Bobby, you are the executive director of an organization called the Eastern Pennsylvania Coalition for Abandoned Mine Reclamation. And that's a long organization name.
Yeah, it's a mouthful.
How do you call it, actually? EPCARM?
EPCAMR.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
EPCAMR for short.
EPCAMR. I didn't know how to venture into that.
Yeah.
And I want to talk with you a great, you know, at length about what's going on with that organization. I've been following you on social media and the organization on social media for many years, and have been impressed with the activity that you've been up to and the work that you do. But as we get started, it's kind of traditional in my podcast to talk to people in the conservation professions, the related professions. And my first inquiry is to ask about yourself personally and, you know, what was it that got you into that field, and what motivated you to become a conservationist?
Well, I mean, for me personally, like growing up as a kid, I grew up in the center of the city in Wilkes-Barre, and my family lived in, there was a low-income housing project called the Wilkes-Barre Boulevard Townhomes.
I know it. I know where it is.
It's
sure.
Right along the main boulevard.
Right, down near the old Stegmaier plant.
Yeah, just down the road from the Stegmaier building off the corner of East Northampton and Pennsylvania Boulevard, which is now Martin Luther King Boulevard. And within that town home growing up, and I'm talking, you know, when we were 8, 9, 10 years old, and this is, I'm born in Agnes, the 50th anniversary of Agnes, just celebrated up here in the valley on June 23rd.
72, right? And,
at about 10 years old in the 80s, you can be with your friends and literally get on a bike or go on a hike. And, you know, you were told, come back when the lights are on, when dinner's ready at 6 o'clock or something. And we don't want to see you in the house until then. Much different situations than what we're seeing today. But we would just tend to get on our bikes. We would roll through different neighborhoods. We would head up either to the back mountain to a reservoir up Route 309 to go swimming or go fishing, or we would head up the other direction to the top of the mountain here in the valley and go to the Laurel Run mine fire, which was pretty unique and still, you know, burning at the time in the 80s, and hang out up there and just take a backpack of snacks and drinks and pretty much hang out for the day. But I was one of these like token naturalists and environmentalists among the kids in the neighborhood. And so I was always interested in wildlife, interested in, you know, trees and rocks, particularly rocks, and geology. So I honed in on that and my skills at a young age to, you know, hop, skip, and jump around these different places. And as I got a little bit older, it was really intriguing me why we had, at that time still, a lot of streams that were running orange, and we had these mine fires all over the place in the region here. Comb banks galore, the waste coal piles, old abandoned coal breakers like the Harry E. and the Huber Breaker and the Dorrance Fan House. These were all places that literally were playgrounds for kids in my age, in my youth at that time, and we thought nothing of it. Because it was fun. You were exploring. You were like an urban explorer. And you checked out these locations and then tried to find out, you know, what is that fan? What's it doing? You know, what was it used for?
Sure.
But you didn't go into the mine tunnels at the time, but you wasn't nothing to hang around a mine fire location or wade through a stream that was orange find your way further up the mountain. Because when you did, oftentimes we would find that those were where these little trout streams were, and we could go fishing in those. And, you know, there was a disconnect at that time, knowing, like, where did the water go? And that was something that I ended up, you know, being very inquisitive about as I got a little bit older.
So did you pursue that educationally?
Yeah, I did. I actually, by the time I was in college, I was the first in my family to go to college, and I got a full scholarship to go to Penn State. And I went to a local branch campus here, Wilkes-Barre, for 2 years. And then I went out to the main campus for another year and a half. I didn't even have to go 4 full years because I was I did some internships while I was here in Wilkes-Barre. I ended up working with the Bureau of Abandoned Mine Reclamation down on State Street in Wilkes-Barre. And that was around 1993. At that time, my job was to go out and do some water monitoring. We were going out locating various boreholes, chopping through knotweed and on mine sites, abandoned mine sites, to find them, to take water readings of what were, I would later find out to be known as the mine pools underneath the valley. And then we were also going to different mine fire sites and using thermocouples and other gas readers to take readings of the various temperatures and gases in places like Centralia, of all places, and other mine fires around.
Now, Centralia is well known as a place where a mine caught on fire, and I guess it's still on fire.
It's still on fire. It happened in the early 60s in a stripping pit that was usually where they would put their waste and their trash, and there was an outcropping of coal, and when you're burning trash and you've got a coal outcrop, once that catches, not usually real easy to put out, but many different scenarios played out there that it could have been done and taken out, or why it wasn't. And it's always this conflict between the community and the government.
Well, now the community there is sort of an abandoned community.
Yeah, there's only seven families down there that are remaining. And just in that particular location, in the last 7 or 8 years here, we've done litter cleanups and trash cleanups with volunteers by the hundreds each year to take care of the majority of the historic dumping that had gone on down there, and removed all the white wall tires that were from the 70s, that we were finding by the thousands. And just last year in April, we planted for the first time like a beautification project where we put in over 150 dwarf apple trees around town to kind of, bring it back a little bit, make it a little more green. And now that a lot of the trash has been removed, what a better way than to, have volunteers come back and have a culmination of a tree plant and of sorts to allow some fruit to bear.
So Bobby, let's drop back just a little bit and describe, if you will, the subject area of your geographic area. It looks to be about a 16 county area in northeastern PA.
Yeah, we cover north central and northeastern PA. North central PA, the counties that are up in what we would call the northern tier, where there's a lot of Marcellus shale activity going on right now, but there is some semi-anthracite and bituminous, smaller bituminous basins that are in, Bradford, and there's Sullivan County and Susquehanna County. And what we're doing up there is, if there are smaller watershed areas that have mining impacts, that have pollution from some old abandoned mines, we're working with local conservation districts and their staff and community organizations and the municipalities or other regional nonprofits that might be in the area that are looking to address those water quality issues and also the land reclamation needs.
The unifying principle obviously is the coal mining activity and the other mining but is it also the Susquehanna River? Is that a unifying?
Yeah, the major portions of the watersheds that we work in are both in the Susquehanna River Basin and the Chesapeake Bay watershed.
Right.
And then the Delaware River Basin and the Delaware Estuary. Those are the two major ones that are in the Epcammer region, because the majority of the coal fields that we work in are their watersheds drain either to the Susquehanna, or when you get down into the Carbon County area and Southern Luzerne County, you're in the upper Lehigh, and that drains to the Delaware and then out to the Bay. And then when you're in the Schuylkill County area in the Southern coal fields, typically all that water is going to the Schuylkill River, and the Schuylkill is a major tributary to the Delaware as well. So other than those areas, the majority of the counties either flow to the West Branch of the Susquehanna in Lycoming County, or they flow to the North Branch of the Susquehanna.
So Bobby, my listeners are from all over the country, really. And for those that are concerned about the water quality in the Chesapeake Bay, there's hardly anything more important than than the water quality in the Susquehanna. I mean, that there the two things are connected, and the Susquehanna water quality is affected by a lot of things, agricultural runoff and other things of that nature. But mine discharge is a major pollutant.
Yeah, within the Susquehanna watershed alone, there's over, I think there's like 1,800 plus stream miles that are impacted by AMD. And there's out of 300 treatment systems.
AMD, acid mine drainage, is that?
Yeah, abandoned mine drainage.
Abandoned mine drainage.
It's typically called acid mine drainage, but some of the water is an acid. Some of it's alkaline in nature. Okay. It can have a higher pH. It doesn't always have to be very low. In terms of pH with acidity values that are really high. And sometimes, depending on the geology, the alkalinity of the water can be a little bit higher, and the pH would be too. And so that's partly a good sign when we see that, because it takes into different treatment options and considerations when you have low pH versus a higher pH, maybe water that has it's loaded with iron versus another discharge that might be a lower pH with aluminum.
Let's drop back just a minute and give people a little bit of a gross perspective on the history there and of that region. And I noticed on your website, the figure I believe was 18 billion tons of anthracite and other coal type products mined in that area.
Yeah, well, here in this region, I mean, and the peak of the mining industry across Pennsylvania was around 1917, and it just took off. And that's when the most employment gains were. That's when the most people were working, when the most collieries up and down the region here, particularly in our region, you could have upwards of 475 coal breakers that were operated, dotting the landscapes, taking the coal in from underground, and turning it into various products in terms of the sizing that was needed for the home heating markets and other markets. So it was a very large industry. And, you know, here we are right before the war, too. I mean, it peaked right before World War One. And at that time, you know, the government was in need of fuel, too. And, you know, we have places like the Tobyhanna Army Depot, and we have Bethlehem Steel, and you've got the Pittsburgh, you know, the Coke Works out in the Pittsburgh region. And all that probably could not have happened, and the rails and the rail lines and things couldn't be produced without both the steel and the slag and the coal that was needed really to not only further the Industrial Revolution, but to get us through the war and the both wars, because we were mining coal even through World War II, and not much of a concern, I would say, for the consequences of what the damage was being done to the environment, because honestly, those laws really weren't starting to take shape until the Clean Water Act in the 1970s. And then you had Safe Drinking Water Act and, you know, the Superfund and CERCLA, and 1977 rolls around. And finally, we come into the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act that really started to regulate the industry under President Jimmy Carter and others that really came to the table and said, maybe now's the time we got to really take a look at this, because
so
we can't
from the mechanics of it. When you mine that much material out from underground and sometimes above ground, but, you know, focusing on underground, I guess you leave a cavity there. Then what happens?
Well, I kind of, when I talk to kids about it, I can, if they've ever seen an ant farm, think of what an ant farm does underground, and the honeycomb and the tunnel networks that it creates, or even like a termite mound underground. That's what it looks like beneath our feet here, where historically with the underground mining, and here in the anthracite region, quite a bit different because of the geology, where we say the coal rolls, it rolls in these anticlines and synclines, which are like you know, roller coasters, basically, when you go across the valley. And so they go up and they go down and they just continue to go up and down. But now they also are running the entire length of the valley. So they're, you know, north and south, and then they're east and west as they roll. And the geology of the coal makes it such that, you know, you've got these long gangways and you've got these offshoots and monkey veins, we call them, and areas
underground,
that are deep in nature. Yeah. And a lot of the local coal mine tours around here, like the Lackawanna coal mine tour in the Stratton area, or the Pioneer Tunnel, are some sites that you could go to and get a good feel underground for what it's like and how they had to prop up the roofs and, you know, mine through those areas to get the coal out. And depending on whether or not you were above or below a water table underground, and they used to pump that water to get at lower elevations of coal, that was historically done. But now that in the region that we're working in, most of the mining underground is ceased to occur. It's not happening very much except for a little bit of independent mining that's going on in the southern coal fields. But for the most part, the pumps are shut off. The water has filled up underground and it comes back to the surface at these abandoned entries. And whether they're boreholes or they're tunnels or they're slopes entries, they're the places that the water tends to come out from that we end up looking at having to deal with and worry about treating.
And the volume of that water is outstanding. I mean, it's just, it boggles the mind how much water that is.
Yeah, it's in the, like, we've done some conservative estimates with just in the Lackawanna and Wyoming Valley areas, 240 billion gallons of water is sitting beneath our feet in the mine pools, we call them. And that's 160 alone is in the Lackawanna area that drains to the Old Forge borehole, which is one of the largest mining pollution impacts to the lower 3 miles of the Lackawanna River. But that underground water sort of complex goes from Old Forge all the way up to underneath the city of Scranton and even up to Archibald, another little borough that's up in the valley up there, just in one mine pool underground. And then the remaining, 80-plus billion gallons in the Wyoming Valley is just between like Pittston and like the Shikshinny area, which is the lower portion of the Wyoming Valley. So there is a lot of water now beneath our feet because it's reached a level which, you know, it's almost at the same level of what the river is because of the alluvial nature of the floodplain of the Susquehanna in our region here locally. But in other areas, there still needs to be work done to map those areas and get the volumes that could be calculated if we know what the levels of the water are from these various borehole locations and the height of the water that it's sitting in underground if there's no pumping or active mining going on in certain areas. And so some of our work takes that into account, and we do some of that monitoring and we do some of that developing of those type of estimations and volume calculations utilizing various software. And
how do you even begin to develop treatment plans for volumes of that size, of that great size?
Yeah, this is the thing right now, and this is why it's important that a lot of the infrastructure money is going to be coming to not only Pennsylvania, but other states that have mining impacts like this, because when you're dealing with this type of water and the volume of water, it's not always going to be something that could be put into a passive constructed wetland type system where maybe you think the plants would, you know, the root system of plants will take up some of the iron and kind of stick to it and adhere to the roots like it's a cheesecloth or it's a, you know, it's a way to soak it up.
So you but, let me stop you. You mentioned iron, and I know that that's an important aspect to understand. Tell us how iron figures into this.
The iron is probably the most common metal that's found in a lot of the mine drainage, not only here in Pennsylvania, but in most coal regions, because the iron pyrite or the pyritic material that is in the rock once the coal has been mined is the interface that gets in contact with both the air and the water. And when that happens, that pyrite, which is, if you think about it, it's fool's gold.
Fool's gold, yes, right, right.
Commonly found on all kinds of rocks underground,
right,
but, and in other countries too. But that interaction between the water and the air interface is what causes the metals to drop out as soon as it reaches the surface, or it drops out underground if the mine pools are not fully flooded and you've still got air as an interface when a pool can actually fluctuate up and down, depending on rainfall events and climatic changes and, you know, loss of water into those mines. So iron tends to be the most predominant metal that we see. And that's why you see a lot of yellow, red, and orange streams in the coal regions that are impacted by AMD.
And so we were talking about plans for remediation of these and what's going on with the infrastructure. Project.
Yeah, well, we're making a big push right now to have that in some of that infrastructure money be utilized for active treatment systems, very similar to what you would see for a sewage treatment plant or what a coal company would have to do for active treatment to maintain a certain level of water quality as they mine and have a permit to discharge their water, but it has to be treated to a certain standard. With these abandoned mine discharges and the volumes of water that we're dealing with, the number of acres that you would need to put this type of volume of water is so large. And in these, some of these areas we're in urban areas too.
Right.
You just don't have that land available here in eastern Pennsylvania, at least. And so you need a smaller footprint and you may need more active treatment scenario options. And with that, you need investment. We know we're not going to get all of that money from the federal government or the state government through grants, but you're going to have to look for partners that might be able to come in with some private investment that would maybe be able to make some money off of the use of the water once it's cleaned up, maybe for industrial use water. It could be have a geothermal use potential. The iron could be recovered for products on the market. And that's just, you know, a few examples of right. what's needed. But we're encouraging different industries and, you know, consultants and groups that have treatment technologies to come to Pennsylvania and come throughout Appalachia and start laying down a business plan that could help to leverage some of these state and federal dollars to make it go a lot further. Because just on the state and federal dollars alone, we would never get to do all of the treatment that we need on, you know, here in Pennsylvania. It's over 5,500 miles of streams that are still impaired. You're just not going to get that done with one or two pots of money and a declining coal industry that puts funds into an abandoned mine land trust fund for every ton of coal that they mine. And it's at a different rate, if whether it's anthracite or bituminous or lignite. It's really pennies on a dollar, but it goes into a fund nonetheless by the industry to go back towards reclamation work in priority health and safety areas of the coal regions. But then this new money and the impetus for the infrastructure money could go towards not only the land reclamation, and we're pushing for it to go towards more AMD treatment, but on the land reclamation side, when typically these funds would just go towards backfilling a hole or a stripping pit or covering up and capping up a vertical opening, now it could be leveraging money that's coming in from industries that want to locate, warehouse distribution centers, manufacturing industries, any other number of industries that would come into a location and put a building pad down on these sites once the holes are filled. And they just need to come in and compact the soil a little bit on the surface, lay down their foundation and their footprint for a building and get some infrastructure in terms of highway connectability and sewer and water.
And this would be for the remnants of above ground of mining activity.
Right? Yeah, mostly on the above ground. You don't see much going on underground. There's
right,
no underground
right.
cities that I'm aware of.
So do you have, or can you point out, what would you say would be the highest priority area to that needs to be addressed in that great big span of counties that you have?
Well, right now what we're seeing, and there's a lot of focus on, is economic development along the major interstate corridors like I-81, Interstate 81, which runs north and south. I-80 is an intersect that's in the eastern middle coal fields and around the Hazleton area. And then when you get further north, 81 runs through the Wyoming Valley. It breaks off to Route 29. It's another corridor that's opened up a lot of coal lands for economic development and both warehouse distribution centers like True Value and Chewy.com and Adidas and Patagonia. So a number of these types of companies are coming in to locate on these former abandoned mine sites in the communities. And then if you go further north into the Lackawanna Valley, you get around the Dixon City and the Route 6 corridor. And those are opening up to a whole lot more development potential for job creation and land reclamation for future development. And on the water quality side, we don't have a lot of big treatment systems here in northeastern PA because the volumes of water are so great that you need a lot of money to really install them. And that's been why this sort of window of opportunity that we have now is really hopeful to be able to take a look at this water in a different way, because we've been only been able to do much smaller discharges with smaller flows with our community groups and partners to address, you know, some tributary type discharges that are coming in further up in the headwater areas of many of these streams in the communities that we're working in.
Right.
But where the large discharges come in the anthracite region, they're so close to the river because they were put in for reasons to drain by gravity that there's not much room to work with. And so you have to look at potentially piping that water or constructing some sort of, concrete brick and mortar building or plant operation to handle that water. And that's not always a cheap alternative, but it's something that we really need to continue to leverage and bring these other private investment opportunities to the region that could use the water.
So Bobby, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Are there examples of treatment plants, if you will, in other areas of the country that have successfully built or engineered plants to deal with this great volume?
In Western Pennsylvania, where there's a large majority of the funded plants that are state run, I think there's 8 of them total, but 7 out of the 8 are pretty much in central to Western Pennsylvania. Now they're treating large volumes of water in active treatment plants with clarifiers that you would very similarly compare to a wastewater treatment plant, where they might have one or two clarifiers. They're adding polymers or they're adding oxygen, and they're aerating the water to allow those metals to drop out.
Got you.
Into ponds before going into the receiving streams. So there's a number of them that are funded. Historically, though, a lot of the passive treatment systems, and I call them passive because it didn't take a lot of maintenance. It didn't have a lot of electricity involved or anything. They just had, you had to turn valves and you had to have people to do that, or you had to let the water settle in ponds and numerous ponds to allow the iron to drop out. And then it's either getting recovered for a recoverable resource for reuse, or it gets landfilled, at a landfill. Mm-hmm. No one finds an alternative use if it fills up too quickly and you get into the operation and maintenance of many of these systems.
I did notice as a passing interest on your website, you have a little store where you sell iron oxide product.
We take some of the iron oxide from some of the systems and the discharges that we've had tested, and a large percentage of what's coming out is that iron oxide precipitate or the pigment. We call it the pigment that we're using. It's basically rust at the bottom of the stream or in the pond. And then we dry it out, and we have a little mini solar kiln and a little soil oven that we can dry the iron oxide product in. And we use it in 5 gallon buckets. We literally are using it for educational and outreach efforts where we tie dye t-shirts and we work with local artists and they create their own paint and different artistic mediums to work in, whether it's watercolor or acrylics or Venetian oils or even pottery glazes. And it gets used in a multiple, multifaceted approach. And then whatever is created, we use those as examples to talk about, you know, just some ways that there's some marketability for iron in particular, for wood stains and being put in concrete and being put into these various artistic mediums right. to help us do some.
Yeah, I used to do a little pottery back in the day, and I can remember mixing glazes that used iron oxide.
Yep.
Very doesn't take much.
No.
Get an effect, but. Yes, I guess it renders a red colors and
it depends on your percentages that are being used right. in your mixture for the glaze. But a good friend of mine, Mark Chuck, who's a ceramics teacher up at Marywood University, he works with it and has done some of our awards over the years. Our Mayfly Award for our annual conference on abandoned mine reclamation, and we give certain awards out to. Individuals that are conservationists over the long term that are protecting and promoting clean water in their mining impacted watersheds. And he's done a few pieces of trout and mayflies utilizing the iron oxide in his glaze up at the university. And
tell me more about trout and mayflies. I know what those are, obviously, but how does that relate to iron oxide?
Well, he uses the iron oxide pigment, the powder in his glaze mixture, and it turns it to a different color. It sometimes will be a greenish color, depending on what he's firing, you know, in the different ceramics, cone 5, cone 6 terminology that he uses for the pottery aspects of what he's doing. But he creates vases, he creates real lifestyle, lifelike fish.
I misunderstood. Well.
Yeah,
you know, I know in your background that you have some involvement with Trout Unlimited.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still a member of my local Stanley Cooper chapter, Trout Unlimited, here locally for many, many years. And we do lots of conservation projects and habitat improvement projects and educational programs with kids and water quality monitoring and even like raising trout in the classroom. We do that here at our office. But I'm still currently the Eastern Vice President. I've been the Eastern Vice President of the State Council for Trout Unlimited for several years, and my term will be up this year in the fall.
Do you have a favorite trout stream in that region?
Oh, up here. Well, yeah. One of my secrets, but I say it's a secret spot. Bowman's Creek in Wyoming County is a very, very good trout stream, and it's where I've caught most of my native brookies. And I don't get out as much as I would really like to, and I haven't caught the real big fish, but a lot of the guys from the chapter always, kid me on, can it get any bigger than 6 or 8 inches, you know, when you're out there fishing or no? And I'm like, well, hey, it's the fight. It's the stealth. It's the
secret. Wyoming County is just a gorgeous daggone place.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful up there. Yeah, a lot of
places,
it's on places lands.
Like is Thornhurst in Wyoming County, Tuncanic.
Tuncanic is a little further north. Yes, that's Mahoopany Creek,
right?
Just the next watershed over, which also has.
That was my dad's favorite place, was Mahoopany.
Yeah, my good friends up there, Rusty Bennett, and I work with them, and they over the years we've done some limestone sand dosing and efforts to two different branches of the Mahoopany Creek because it's got some acid swamps up in the headwaters and a few minor. Sort of discharges that come into a few tributaries, but over the years they've been taken care of, and now they sort of use some limestone for lime in the fields for when they're doing plots, food plots and stuff, and that also helps the watershed and combats a lot of the up there it's acidification, sometimes it's just the rainfall that comes down in that area. And there's no buffering capacity in those streams because there's no limestone, it's a lot of hemlocks and tannic acids and swamps that produce some more of that acidity that can be combated the same way with limestone type treatment systems.
So you build like a little cofferdam, weir dam? out of limestone and let the water flow through it, that kind of
thing? Yeah, sometimes you put it right along the shore and wait for a high flow. And then when the high flows come, they knock the sand right in and then it buffers it because it's getting the biggest like slug of acidity would be coming down during a rain event. So they'll pile it along the sides of the road or near a culvert or in a channel to be able to be picked up during the higher flows. In the past, I think we've done some small like wooden cribs. And you can do little cribs and you can put limestone rock in it. And then as the water falls through that,
it does it,
you know, and then erodes the softer calcium carbonate, high calc into the stream. And that helps somewhat as well.
Yeah. That sounds like a real effective way to deal with small, small volumes. Obviously can't be used for the great big borehole type.
No, and you don't. You don't use limestone very much in a iron discharge. You'll use it at the very end. If you can, you got to remove the metals first because if you don't, the iron will just coat the limestone and will armor it.
Oh my goodness!
It has an armoring effect of not being able to allow the limestone to be dissolved away.
So interesting.
Yeah, so we typically would use a limestone in a very acid condition, low pH, that we need to pick the pH of the water up to like a 5.55. And when that happens in aluminum impacted waterways that have problems with AMD, that precipitate, very similar to iron, will drop out in a pond or in a polishing area. And then you have a higher pH water going back to the receiving stream. And if you got two, if it's to kill two birds at one stone, if you have an iron and aluminum discharge, like the Jetto mine tunnel that drains the Hazelton Basin in the eastern middle coal fields outside of Drums and Drums Elementary in the Cunningham Valley, then you've got to deal with both the iron and the aluminum. And that's such a large volume discharge that people are still trying to find ways, and we're still trying to find ways to best come up with a suitable treatment solution for that large discharge to the Nescopeck Creek that also drains to the Susquehanna River.
Bobby, I wanted to point my listeners to your website, EPCAMR, Eastern Pennsylvania Coalition of Abandoned Mine Reclamation. If you go to their website, it's quite an impressive site, an array of information. One of the features, which I thought was so cool, was your mapping project. And this is a 3D mine pool mapping project that encompasses virtually the whole region. Tell us about that. It's making use of GIS and other technologies. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, what we've been doing for a number of years now, probably the last decade or more, some of the staff, I mean, they're pretty savvy in terms of, they're GIS specialists and they're technicians and they have backgrounds in geographic information systems and mapping. And what we are doing and have been doing for the state under an agreement with them, a grant that has been over 8 years now, has been taking any of the surface and underground mine maps that are in their collections at their offices and or private collections, if they're willing to give them to us from different coal companies, and taken those maps and we scanned them, we digitized them, we geo-referenced them. And by doing that, I mean we are taking locations off the maps, we're taking elevations off the maps, and we're taking a 2D map.
Tie it to a specific point.
To create it to 3D, because Z, AXYZ, the Z is the elevation. The Z is the thickness. And we know what the coal thicknesses are from the mine maps. And we can tell what's been mined and what's not. And we will digitize and outline the areas that have been mined. And so that leads us to know that if the mining was done and the barrier pillars and the areas that would normally have held up the roofs, if they were removed during what we call retreat mining or second and third or fourth mining on their way out, that's all void space, or a majority of it would be. And so you could only think that that would be filled up with water. But if we have boreholes that are on those maps that show that they go to the different elevations underground, we know what the water elevation is. And that helps us to do some of the volumetric calculations that we've worked on in some of the three-dimensional modeling aspects of work that we've done in the region on a regional basis. But when you really want to hone into it, you've got to have the maps for a particular area and you need to know where the water does flow and doesn't, if there are these coal barrier pillars that used to keep water from entering one mine to the next, or if they've been breached. If you recall, here in Pennsylvania, we had the Kew Creek disaster a number of years ago, and there was water that filled up in a mine, and because they went through a barrier pillar, water came through, and there were some trapped miners. That's because they didn't have really good mapping at the time of what was on the other side of that pillar. And it turned out to be a whole other, you know, volume of water underground that inundated that particular area. So it's very important not only to do it for water calculations, but just mine subsidence and people's homes that live up on top of these areas. They now can go to the a website that's housed by Penn State. It's called mindmaps.psu.edu, and they can look for their home by street address and find out just how many maps or mines might be beneath them. And that if they qualify for the mine subsidence insurance program, they go ahead and go through that process with the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, not through us. We're just doing the legwork,
right,
but
right.
Probably over 20,000 maps have gone into the Northern anthracite and some of the other anthracite coal fields here in Northeastern PA that we've worked on alone over the last decade.
You know, I can remember as a child, my family, we lived in Cincinnati, but we would travel back to Wilkes-Barre in the summers and visit with family. And in the 70s, in the early 80s, I can remember that mine subsidence was a great big issue in the city of Wilkes-Barre, because the mines were underground, but they weren't that far underground. And so, you know, buildings like GAR High School, as I recall, was developing structural issues. For my listeners that don't know what GAR is, Grand Army of the Republic High School, and it's a major high school in the city of Wilkes-Barre. Did you go to school there?
I went to school there from 7th grade through 10th grade.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And then my parents moved to South Wilkes-Barre, and I had to transfer to E.O. Myers High School.
To Myers High School, right. Neither of those schools exist today, as my recollect.
GAR is now a elementary or a junior high school.
All right.
And the Wilkes-Barre Area School District has just relocated all of their senior high students to Plains Township in a new school that was built over a former abandoned mine site, North Cross Valley. And Myers has closed down and is being converted to some other use right now.
Right, right. Well, the point is the mine subsidence, and they were flushing the mines back in those days, which I never really did understand how that was going to help. But it's still an issue in that area.
Yeah. The flushing projects that were going on at that time were to put a slurry down of either coal ash or coal silts and cement. And then they would try and fill up some of the void spaces, depending on where those areas were, to help solidify them and, really pour an open room turn it into a, concrete filled cave area to hopefully support some of the area on the surface, because, mine subsidences are conical. Like when stuff starts falling at the bottom of the mine, to get to the surface, it keeps going outwards. So the holes are bigger at the surface, and they only have to be smaller at the bottom, depending on where the subsidence starts. And so they were looking to try and fill a lot of those voids in the region here at that time. So those slurry injection projects, as they were called, were quite often done probably in the late 70s, right after Agnes, too.
Right,
because
right.
Fluctuation of water in the mines.
And did they work? Did they help?
I mean, some of the slurry projects did help, I think, and prevented some subsidence from occurring. But there are still occasional subsidences that will occur depending on the high water flows that we get. I know Pittston area is really prone to mine subsidence. It's very close, to the river and the confluence with the Lackawanna. So it sees a lot more activity in terms of that. But you just never know when things are going to give underground. If it's an old wooden prop or a timber or an area gets eroded away during a storm event and water flows through and takes out a bunch of silt or coal silt and fines that might have been there, And as that gets washed away, it opens up more space for there to be potential for subsidence.
Bobby, I guess one of the major events that, you know, if you're talking about history and coal mining in that area, one of the major events that kind of was a death knell to the industry was the mining under the Susquehanna that inundated and killed a bunch of miners.
There was 12 miners that died in the Knox mine disaster.
That's what it was called, right.
And that happened on January 12th of 1959. So that was even earlier. That preceded Agnes. They got a little too close to some of the veins that were underneath the river at the sort of the along the edge of the river. And there are all these stop lines that they're called, that they're safety zones that you're not supposed to be really mining under, especially when you're near a river or near a stream. But, you know, 9 times out of 10, every mine map that I look at, if I look at the safety zone or the stop lines, they mine right underneath them. They got more coal and maybe got a little too greedy, and they wanted to take home a little bit more money, or they were being told by their company to do that. And many of those miners were entombed, but some got away and some got out of the maze shaft. And there's a really good documentary. I worked with Al Bracca and Dave Bracca, who put together, they're from the Pittston area and they got ties to the region here. And KnoxMineDisaster.com is their website, and they showcasing. And I know they've been putting the documentary into a lot of film festivals, so I don't know how it's being released right now, but they've had screenings of it here locally for a number of years in the last few years, and may be open to doing more of that. But I don't know if they're just trying to get a distribution deal or something out there to get it moved along a lot further. But that's definitely worth checking out too, KnoxMineDisaster.com.
So interesting. Well, Bobby, thank you so much for joining me today. I have to tell you, I was in Wilkes-Barre this spring for, unfortunately, a funeral. But, you know, over the years, I've noticed that Wilkes-Barre and the surrounding areas, the cleanup, it's obvious that people are working on it. I mean, I can remember as a child, as you described earlier, the big piles of mine refuge that were around town everywhere, and the abandoned, mine operations, and those things really are not on the landscape, in the city area so much.
No, many of them are reclaimed now. Yeah. There are just a few dot in the landscapes. We're working on one in Sawyersville Borough that's like 55 acres, and we're only in phase one of that. And that's a $12 million project just to do 15 acres of the silt basin portion of it. That's over 30 feet deep. And we didn't even get to the phase two along the back road. That's another 45 acres that will need more money down the road for continued reclamation efforts. But it's an opportunity that if that bank, which has been there for 60 years, once it gets removed, the borough of Sawyersville will be able to, the community will see one side of the town that they've never seen in 60 years. And a community athletic area is going to be part of that reclamation for community development right smack in the middle once the first phase is done that we're working on. So there's going to be this opportunity to reconnect the people in the community together through open space and green space that was once, you know, a desolate landscape of waste coal. Really fueled the industry at one point and gave people jobs when it was the only job in town.
Exactly. So, it's just so cool to see this sort of activity happening and the really scars upon the land that were so obvious and ugly for so many years there in that area are being repaired. It's a slow process. It's not happening overnight.
No.
But I'm thrilled to talk with you about that and give you all kinds of praise for the activity that you're doing and the related organizations. I know your organization is a membership organization involving citizens and other organizations from around the region. Kudos to you all for the work that you're doing.
Yeah, thanks. We're a small staff. We're a small shop. We got like 4 full-time, 3 part-time. We're all grant-funded and foundation-funded and through donations to do our work. And so we kind of do the shoestring budgets on any and all projects until we can secure the proper amount of funding and partnerships to get the work done. But that's what the coalition has been about, and that's how we operate. And I don't do it alone. I couldn't do most of this work without the staff that are here to doing the legwork and doing the technical work and the monitoring on the ground. We are boots on the ground to help move these projects forward. But somebody's got to be out there, you know, hitting it home and hammering it and meeting with the politicians, meeting with the legislators to make sure that this is an important issue on behalf of the communities we're working in. So that's our job, and that's what we try and do.
Well, Bobby, thank you so much for joining me today, and I certainly wish you the best of luck with your future activities.
Thanks, Mark. I really appreciate you taking the time to call.